Okay, we'll make a start. We're on page 40, page 40 of the Blue Books, chapter 11, Perikei Yudalev. Had a bit more time to look at the where we're going with this, because after this week, we're going to jump, Mirat Hashem, next week to chapter 22. If you read through from 11 through 21, you'll see that most of it is the division of the land. And the division of the land with all the different cities and the cities of refuge and a lot of stuff. We may make one or two comments, but in terms of parochim to learn, we've got essentially 22, 23, and 24. So although it seems a bit cheating a bit, we're missing out half the Sefer, the reality is that's the main focus of Sefer Yehoshua. After we finish Mitzvah Hashem in a couple of weeks, I was thinking maybe we'll do something. If it's around Pesach, hopefully before Pesach, we'll do something on Shir Hashirim, which will be interesting. Not many people sort of get a chance to look at that. And then after Pesach, Megillas Ruth, to do a bit about Ruth. And finish that before Shavuos. That would be a nice sort of finishing off there. And it sort of ties in with what we're learning anyway. Alright, so remember last week we saw Perek Yud, the sun standing still, and the fantastic Nes. And we pointed out that was the miracle of the victory over the southern kingdom, okay, the kingdoms of the south, basically from Yerushalayim downward, okay. You've got all those various places that we mentioned last week, and the kings came together, and it was one total disaster for them, and they were all obliterated. Now, Perek Yud Aleph is the corollary, is the kingdoms of the north. And they all gathered together in a place called Chatzor. Chatzor, I think there's been excavation. I know there is a new place called Chatzor. I don't think it's in the original location, but I know that they've been digging around there, and they found all different things. I haven't sort of followed that up, but I remember, I think, even visiting there once. And as I said last week, really the big question of chapter 11 is why things took so long. The basic time frame is that the war... to finish the war against these tribes that were in the land of Israel took 7 years. Okay, the war that we read about last week in the south took 3 months. So you talk about another almost six and three quarter years when they're fighting the kingdom of the north. And Yeshua seems to schlep it out. It's being schlepped out. And on top of that, there was another 7 years of division. So it took another 7 years to divide up the land. That's why you've got like another 10 chapters just telling you how the land was divided up. And then you've got another 14 years when Yeshua was still alive. So you have essentially Yeshua's reign, if you want to call it that, is 28 years. So there's a big problem here. There's a big question. And the big question is, if he could finish off the south in 3 months, why didn't he finish the north? It would have taken 3.5 months, you know. I mean, why did it drag out to take 7 years to finish the war? And that's a question which is, in fact, gives us a tremendous insight to Yehoshua. There's a minor question which we're going to deal with in before that, which is the command that he has in terms of the horses. We know that in Jewish tradition, Tzar Bali Chaim, we've got to be careful about not causing pain to living creatures. And we know that we believe that's one of the seven Noahide laws, as well as one of the laws that we are very particular about. I always remember hearing, first time I heard, I think, was from Jonathan Sacks, one of his lectures, that he spoke about this famous response of the Nodi Yehuda about fox hunting. Could Jews be fox hunters? Could they go and hunt for pleasure? There was a Jew in Czechoslovakia at that time who had a big estate, and he wanted to go and do fox hunting. He wanted to keep the foxes down. And he wrote to the Nodi Yehuda, who was Rabbi Chezkel Lando in Prague, can I do it? So he wrote back to him, and he said, basically, you know, I'm not telling you it's awesome, but it's pasnished. It's not, you know, you got better things to do with your life than running around chasing animals, blowing trumpets, and all the rest of it, like you see these pictures from England and other places. And it's so interesting. And again, it revolves, he does talk a bit about the whole concept of Tzar Bali Chaim, etc. And it's one of those things that we are very sensitive about. We certainly would support animal rights to a certain extent, yeah. He did permit it, yeah, he allowed it, but he said that, you know, who are the hunters in the Torah? Nimrod and Esav, and he said these are not people that we should aspire to be like, all right? And it reminds me of the speech that I heard many years ago at a bar mitzvah, and it was a bar mitzvah suda, and the I was invited as the rabbi, this was in England, connected to one side of the family, and they had a reform rabbi came. And the reform rabbi got up and said, "This young man, you should be like Esau," he said. "You should be like Esau." And he gave a whole drasha about how Esau is such a healthy individual. You should be a healthy young man. All right, I suppose you can read it that way, but it was a strange thing to say. Yes?
This week's parsha, Shpatim,
yeah.
It should be, it says,
yeah.
Maybe that's why it took so long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's going to be some, we're going to have to say something about that. All right? It comes into the discussion, the whole question of how long it was going to take and the promises and the nevuahs. We'll come to it. All right? So you've hit on a point, and we will talk about that. We'll go through the chapter, and again, as I said, we'll deal with this thing about the animals, and then we'll come to the main question in a few minutes. So listen to this. I think we said page 40. Chapter 11. Vayhi, kishma yovi melech hatzor, vayishlach el yovav melech madon, vayomelech shimron, vayomelech achshav. Now we've got all the kings of the north coming together. And the main protagonist is somebody called Yovin. Yovin Melech Chatzor. And he gathers all the kings together. Posuk Bet. Vel ha-melachim asher mitzvon in the north, Bahar, Barava, Negev, Kinarot, Bashvela. Basically, from Jerusalem northwards, Shvela, going towards Tel Aviv, all of that whole area, going up the country, all of those kings, Ubenafot, Dor, Miyam. And in the region of Dor. Right? Remember later on, we saw the story of the witch of Endor, Endor. Right, there is a kibbutz there in Ein Dor in that area today, which is an interesting place. I actually visited that kibbutz once. And it says, Gimel, Haknani mimizrach umiyam. We had the Canaanites from the east and from the west. Vehem Moiri, Vachiti, Aprizi, Avusi, Bahar, all of those tribes on the mountains, Vachivi, Tachas Chermon, right up to the Chermon, skiing season, right? You go to the Chermon to ski. Be'eretz HaMitzpah, in the land of Mitzpah, which is right up in the north. All of these kings came together. Dalet, Ve'yetzuheim v'chol machaneim imam, Am Rav k'chol asher sfateyam l'rov. Now this was a massive army, which again the Bible describes not in numbers, but in impressions, right? It looked like essentially a sea of people. Sfateyam l'rov looked like the sand by the seashore. V'sus v'rechev rav ma'od, and many horses and many riders. So this was a formidable army which was coming against the Jewish army. Hey, vayavadu kol ha-malachim ha-ele, and they all got together, all the kings. Vayavadu v'yachnu yachta v'mei marom, they went to Mei Marom. We're not quite sure where that is, but there is a suggestion. It's a place that, it's somewhere in the region of Meron today. All right, we all know Meron, I hope, at least, you know, sort of from reputation. Hopefully most of us have been there. There's a wonderful mikveh there, of the Ari, which is the most freezing mikveh you'll ever attempt to dip in your life. Freezing. I mean, it's a natural stream. So in the middle of the summer, it's a great place to go. Any other time of the year, and it's only for men, the women don't use it. It's one of those places that you always get the yeshiva guys going there. They go in nice and healthy and they come out looking a bit worse for wear, but it's an experience. The Ari promise, you go to that mikveh, you won't die without doing tshuva. I think you probably, that's what he said. So you'll come out with other diseases, but you'll do tshuva as well, yes.
Polar bear.
Sorry? It's like the polar bear club. It's an unbelievable thing. It's there's a lot of good stories about that mikveh, but anyway. All right, so that's approximately where we're having this power. Around Meron, you know, sort of with the road going up to Tzfat, somewhere around that. And it's Lilachem in Israel, they're going to fight with Israel. So again, they've got God on their side. Hashem says to Yeshua, don't be afraid. Right? And Yeshua doesn't move a muscle without any sort of promise or any sort of confirmation from God. And Hashem says, Ki macha kesazos, at this time tomorrow, Anochi nosenes kulam chalolim lifnei Yisrael, they'll all be corpses. Every single one of them will be dead. Wow. Esuseim ta'akeh, and he's given a special command to make the horses lame. These are horses of war. Alright, when you ever see the war movies, you'll see, you know, sort of in the older Braveheart and all those sort of movies, a lot of horses were used in the charges, right? They're, even up to the First World War, there's this wonderful player that came from England, War Horse, which Spielberg made a movie out of it. And the horses were really very part of the war effort. So here, God is commanding Yeshua to take the horses and make them lame. Don't kill them. Ta'akeh means literally to uproot or to damage the hooves, right? Bet markavosem tisrof ba'esh. And then the chariots you shall burn in fire. Okay, and this is what they were told to do once the battle was over. And this is the question. The question is, why didn't they just take the horses back? Why didn't they take them home with them? All right, and we know later on that, for instance, we learned about Shlomo HaMelech, that he had stables with thousands of horses. All right, again, it was all an army which was hopefully never going to come into any sort of practical use. And for Shlomo, for most of his life, all of his life essentially, the army was never used. So right at the end, when it says he has started having trouble with Egypt. But basically, that was an army there as a prevention. It wasn't there to fight. It was there to impress the enemy. You know, I've got more horses than you, therefore leave me alone. And this, of course, is what happens today. You know, this is the whole situation with Israel today. As long as we can keep ahead in the arms, then, you know, we can always show the army is stronger than one is stronger than the other, then it's a deterrent. Yeah.
You said that they weren't supposed to do this until after the battle.
Well, you'll see what happens. He said to him after the battle, this is what you're going to do. The command was before. The battle takes place, and then as a result, the horses have to be dealt with in this way. And this, again, is very uncharacteristic of what we normally do.
So it would make more sense to disable them before the battle.
Well, if you can get to them. But the thing is, you'll see what happens. Let's see how it plays out. Look at Zion. Ve'yavo Yoshua v'cholam ha'milchama imo aleihem al me'marom pit'om. Everything is done suddenly. They came upon the enemy in me'marom suddenly. Ve'yiplu bahem, and they fell upon them. And obviously they weren't prepared for them. And this battle was all over before it started. Chet, vayidneim Hashem b'yad Yisrael, they were given over by God into the hands of Israel. Vayakum, and they smote them. Vayiridufum, and they chased them. Ad Sidon Rabbah, till they got to Sidon, which is already going up towards, well, now there's what is Lebanon. Vayad Misrafot Mayim, until this place called Misrafot Mayim. Vayad Bikat Mitzpeh Mizracha, till the valley of Mitzpeh to the east. By Yaakov, and they continued to smite them. Ad bilti yishilem sarid, nothing was left. Unbelievable! It was a complete and utter destruction of the enemy. And at this point, obviously, now they've overtaken the enemy, the chariots and the riders, and now they've got all the horses. By Yaslem Yeshua kasher malav Hashem et susem iker. He did what God told him to do, and he made the horses lame. Ved Markov Osem Saraf Ba'esh, and he burnt the chariots. So just a quick comment about this whole thing of the horses. And there's an interesting thing. I'll just read this to you from the Gemara Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara Avodah Zarah, page 11. Eza Iko She'em Batrefa HaMenasheh Parsosel She'obahem Menakuvah Lamata. He explains that what they did is that they made the horses from the hoof. The hoof area was crushed, or whatever they did to it. Sounds very, very cruel. But listen to this. And of course, the question that the Gemara raises is, isn't this tzar balichai? Aren't you causing pain to a living animal? So the Gemara says like this, b'nosei v'nosein bashuk shel avodas kochovim, behema te'akar. So there's a whole Gemara about when you're having business with the non-Jews in terms of buying animals. This was maybe one of the practices that they would indulge in. And the Gemara says, but wait a minute, but we did it, and surely it was considered to be causing pain to animals. Amar Abai, Amar Rachmanus, so Abai explains, it's the same to Aker. It says with Yeshua that they were mutar lirdotam b'chal. You're allowed to do this in this case. And that's basically what the Gemara says. But of course, it doesn't really answer the question. Thank you very much. You've just told us that it happened. And they were allowed to do it. So what does it mean? How could it be allowed if this is causing pain to the animals? And the answer is found essentially in the Radak. And the Radak on Pasuk Tet. Which I'm not going to go through. I'll just give you the gist of what he says. And this is, again, this is from a sefer that we've referred to many occasions from somebody called Yitzhak Levy, who wrote this wonderful set of books on the early part of Tanakh. And he says like this. He says, what was going on over here after the war was won over? He says like this, that, let me just get the quote here. Yeah, he says, "Velotziv ala hamit susim," that the command was not to kill the horses. Kiloya davar shasu banaa, was that, you know, you could have taken the horses, you could have actually had benefit. Aval asusim she'enam ela l'milchama, but the horses which were used for war, otam tziva la'akod, those were the ones that they had to make lame, kedei shelo yikchom ve'yivtechu behem. Wow. Had they taken these horses, and you know what would have happened? The next battle, they've all got up on the horses, the Jews talking about. They would have ridden the horses, and they would have thought, we're now going to win the enemy because we've got better weapons. Unbelievable. And the message of this war, of this event, particularly with the horses, was to say, lo b'chayo v'lo b'kach. You know, that the Jewish army doesn't depend on strength, it doesn't depend on numbers, in the end of the day, it depends on their trust in God. It's an amazing thing. And the Radak says this. He says that, in fact, he was not commanded to destroy the horses, because he says, Osala Ashris, you're not allowed to do it. Velo tamuta behema biikar, and by doing this, the animal would not die by making them lame. Elishalo to chalalecha, the only thing is, it can never walk again. Vimtimtsa mireh, certainly not to ride hard as in the case of war. And if you find a place where it can go and pasture, you know, you'll find a place, then tichia, the animal can live. And that is the suggestion. The idea is that there had to be a message here. And Reb Levi explains it like this. He says, Lomdu Yisrov Omod Mechamazu Gamleka. They learned a message, a lesson. Ein HaMelech Noshe Barav Chayim. So Pasuk in Tehillim, that the king is not saved because of the greatness of the army, Gibelo Yinotza Barav Koch, or the strong man because of his strength. Sheka Asus Litshua. Right, we actually say it every day. Eile Varechev, Eile Basusim. It's every morning, right? I mean, I know we're sort of thinking about taking off our tefillin or whatever, but it's a pasuk, fantastic pasuk, that these come with their horses and these come with their chariots. V'anachem b'shem Hashem nazkir, that we come in the name of God. And, you know, that's always been the way that Jews have battled. And with all due respect to the IDF and everything that it represents, which is beyond words, but it's the element of emunah and bitachon and everything that goes into it. My wife's cousin told me when I got my uniform and I was in the basic training in 1980, whatever it was, well, a long time ago, 85. He said, when you get your uniform, you should say Shechiyonu. And I said to him, Shechiyonu, on an army uniform? He said, yeah. He said, for 2,000 years, this did not exist. He said, we are putting on an army uniform for a Jewish army in the first time in 2,000 years. That's a reason for saying Shechiyonu. That was a great drosha, by the way. He's a good guy. He was in America's Arab for a long time, this guy. And that's what he told me. He said, you should really, when you put on your uniform the first time, Shechiyonu. It's not a new uniform. It's new for me, but it's not a new one, but not brand new. But whatever. He said, Shechiyonu is an absolute. Okay, and that to me was something I never forgot that, because it really said it all. Sorry?
Did you venture?
And I said, yeah, a whole group of us, you know, and I told them, I said that this is a Shechiyon, and we did it. Again, you know, it depends. It wouldn't go down very well in Me'er Sharim, but that's the way it goes. But think about it. It's a phenomenal thing. It wasn't just on the uniform, right? It was on the concept of what the uniform was about. Okay, I'm Elliot's T-shirt this morning. I don't think you say Shechiyonu on your T-shirt. You're still wearing that T-shirt, right? You got your today's your Tzahal day. Yes, I thought so. Yeah, I thought I spotted it. But in the real sense, it was really something. So he says, "Barov chelola yimaled." You know, with the army, it's not going to succeed. It won't save you. It's all about trust in God. You see what happens here? That not only does Yeshua do this to the horses. Go back to the text. Yud. Then Yeshua captures Chatzor, which is like the city, which is the central staging post for all of this stuff. And he killed the king, as he did with all the other kings. This was the head of all the kingdoms. And he destroyed Chatzor. And again, this is a message. The message is, and there's a whole Gemara about it. A midrash is found in Bereishit Rabbah, where it talks about the fact that either this was done as a masorit, they were told to do it as a tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu. When you get to the headquarters, you destroy it. Or the suggestion is that they destroyed it because there are examples of the non-Jews attacking in war B'nai Yaakov, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded at that point, in different situations, obviously thinking back to Shechem or whatever, that when you win this particular battle, the mitzvah is to destroy the enemy. There's like a tradition going back a long way. It was a sign of victory. When you set fire to the city, when you destroyed their power base, then that was something that would hit, you know, to the heart of those people. And there's no half measures here. You've got to do what you've got to do. So that's Yud Aleph. You'll see. Vayakvet kol ha-nefesh asher ba lefi cherev ha-chrem, destroyed all the people there. Lo notak on the shamavet chatzor saraf ba'esh, and he set fire to chatzor. So that, again, is sort of part A of what we're going to discuss. The reason for the horses to be put lame and to destroy the city and everything else is to send the message that we are coming not with power, not coming with might, not coming with force, you know, the overwhelming force. We're coming in the name of God. And that's a pretty strong message. Yud Bet. Now we'll go back to the text. Bet kol harei amlachim ha'ele, bet kol machihem, lechad yoshua v'yakem lefi cherem, hecherim otam. So everything was captured by the sword, was destroyed, kasher tzivo Moshe eved Hashem, as Moshe had commanded, which is the what you were referring to, this idea of the destruction that was already told from the days of Moshe. Rak kol ha'arim ha'omdot al tilam lo sarfam Yisrael. There were certain cities which stayed where they were. They weren't burned down. Zulati et chatzol levada saraf Yoshua. It seems to be, it points out that certain cities were taken over. Maybe they were obviously abandoned, and therefore the Jews could go and live there. And at this point, the only city that was really treated in the north the way that, say, Yericho had been treated and the other places which had been destroyed was the city of Chatzor. What happened to the spoil, Yudalot? Kol shalal ha'arim ha'ele v'abehemot bazazu lehem b'nei Yisrael. And as far as the spoils are concerned, they took the animals, etc. Rak et kol adam hikul lefichere, but no cat, no prisoners. Everybody was killed. Hashmidam utam lo hishiru kol neshama. And this is obviously a reference to the mitzvah of the Torah, lo techayeh kol neshama, that nobody was allowed to continue living. There is an interesting thing I saw here. I don't remember now where I saw it, that lo techayeh kol neshama can have sort of, it has different connotations, different interpretations. I'll bring it in what I saw, hopefully for next week, because there's an interesting comment of the Netziv, where he says that mitzvah, which is such a difficult mitzvah for us to get our head around, the idea essentially of destroying the enemy completely, man, woman and child, and he explains that obviously this is not something that we put into our tradition only at that time because of the concept of what they represented, the negative influences that they represented. It was very extreme. Very extreme. And in fact, the ones that they didn't kill became very, very problematic, as we already learned in Sefer Shoftim, the issues of the influences that they represented. But let's deal with Yeshua for a few more minutes. Tedva. Kasher tziva Hashem et Moshe avdo, God commanded Moses, kein tziva Moshe et Yeshua. So Moshe passed it on to Yeshua, as we expect. Chenas Yeshua, and Yeshua did it. Nothing was missed out. Everything was done the way it was supposed to do. Ted Zayin. Ve'ikach Yoshua et kol ha'aretz hazot, and he took the whole land. Ha'har ve'et kol ha'negev ve'et kol ha'aretz ha'goshen. This land of Goshen was not, again, we mentioned it last week, it's not Egypt Goshen. It's, I suppose, when they came back to, it's either that the Egyptians took the name from this part of Israel, which was supposed to be very nice, called Goshen. I don't know exactly where it is. Probably somewhere around Rehavim, my guess is, you know, sort of nice part of Israel, wherever. Who knows where it was? It was somewhere in that in the country, and it was called Goshen. All of this was taken over by Yoshua. Vet Hashvela, Vet Korava, the low part and the plains, Vet Har Yisrael Shvelotan, the mountains and the valleys, etc. Minahar Chalak Oles Seir. It went from Har Chalak, which is a strange place. Rashi says Tura She'il, all right, which I guess is a place that is called literally the smooth mountain. All right, the question is, where is that? Machlik Ahar, Rashi says, Posa Yudzayin, Machlik Ahar, Achalak Ad Bal Gad, Meitzar HaMizrahi, Velo Hispik Lichvosh Bechayav Et Kol HaMeitzar, Aratzafon. Right? There seems to have been, and I'll just read the translation, the smooth mountain to Balgad on the eastern border, and he was unable to conquer the entire border to the north during his lifetime. So Rashi is already pointing out that Yoshua got to a certain point but did not manage to completely conquer everything that he was commanded to conquer. And this is one of the psukim that gives us the limitations of how far he got. He got over to the east, I suppose now what we would call Samaria, Shomron, that sort of more mountainous area, but didn't take it all the way to the north and on that side of the country. That's why those pockets of the other nations that were there managed to stay there. So Yud Zayim, in Ahara Chalaka Oles Seir Ad Balgad BeBikat Levanon. This came to the valley of Bikat Levanon, which is right in the north, where the Hezbollah at the moment are making so much trouble. Just hope that, you know, Shem Yirachem, that we shouldn't have to go through that again. Tachad Har Chemon, right up to the Chermon. Ve'et Kol Machihem Lochad Ve'yakem Ve'imitem. And again, took the kings, captured them, and killed them. They were all done away with. Yomim Rabim. Now here comes the pasuk, which again we want to just think about. It says many days. Doesn't say how long. Yomim Rabim. Asa Yoshua. Look at Rashi before we continue the pasuk. Yomim Rabim. Asa Yoshua. Bignuto Sipera Katu. This is not a praise of Yoshua. It's the opposite. It's saying that he didn't do the right thing. Shayamit Kaven Litchot et Kibush Haaretz. He delayed the conquest of the land. Kedela Rich Yama. And the suggestion is because it would give him extra days to live. Lefishinema, because it says Vata Tanchilena Otam. You are supposed to divide it up. So as long as you haven't finished conquering and dividing, you're still gonna live. Yeah, it's an incredible thing this.
So I have to say he didn't have to be tough on that. If God wanted him to live 50 years, he'll live 50 years.
It's a pillow plan, and Rashi says it. Rashi brings us in Medrash Tanchum. It's unbelievable. And it gives them fortune, tremendous heartache. It's almost as if you're saying, you know what, he's using this kind of excuse to extend his life, right? And in fact, he dies, he's 110 years old, he was meant to live to 120, and he lost 10 years of his life, according to Chazal, for this very reason. He should have lived 120, yeah.
What about that pasuk that I said, they weren't going to wipe everybody out, they were going to leave the land desolate.
Yeah.
So, you know, you conquer them, you put some people in there,
and then you continue going.
You
yeah.
wiped everybody out, the land would be desolate. You had wild animals running yeah. around, the land would get spoiled.
Yeah, but the idea was that they would then sort of divide it up, as you'll see in the next few chapters, right? And fill those gaps. But you're right. You're right. There comes a certain point, and it says that Yoshua did not completely destroy the whole infrastructure, right? But what they did, what they were commanded to do, was attack the people. The cities were left. We just read that. So one assumes that that was the idea, that they would then populate those cities stage by stage, okay? And the idea then would be to make the land become as productive as we know it could be. Okay, we see it today, and we've certainly in those days, one assumes it was of a similar nature. It's always been this incredible thing. Once the Jews live in Eretz Israel, they can produce from the land what nobody else can produce. It's a desert. Look at those pictures from 150 years ago. David Roberts, I think his name was, a Scotsman, who went around drawing paintings of Israel. Everything was desert. It was rocks, nothing. In the same place, you know, I think somebody put side-by-side pictures with what it is today. You can't believe it's the same place. And it's when the Jews touch anything in Eretz Israel, it becomes like gold. It's an amazing thing. And it goes back to the Arab, and then it becomes sand. Everything gets covered over with sand, and it's lost. It's one of those things which I can't explain it. I have no explanation for that. We'll come back to this. Just hold that thought for a minute. We'll just finish the chapter, then I wanted to just deal with Yoshua and his campaign here, because it is a very problematic situation. So again, it says, Yomim Rabim, Pasuk Yudchet, Asa Yoshua et Kolam Lachim Ha'ele, Milchamas. He made war for many days. Lo aita ira sheshlimat bnei Israel. We know that was no one who made peace. Bilti achivi Yoshua given except for the Gibeonites. Et hakol lachu milchama, and everything was taken in war. Ki me'et Hashem haita. This was all from God. Lechazeket libam, to strengthen their heart. Likrat milchamat Yisrael, towards to make the Jews be strong towards the idea of war. Leman achrimam, to destroy the enemy, they should have no favor whatsoever. In order to destroy them, as God had commanded. Uminanav, there were still these Anakim, whatever they were, very tall people, and they were destroyed from those areas from Hebron, right? I never really understood what this Anakim was really referring to. Is it physical height, or is it some sort of extra thing? We know that Avraham Avinu was befriended by certain gentlemen in that particular part of the country. So maybe Anakim means giants of spirit. I just don't know. But obviously over the years, they carried on living there. And by this time, obviously, they weren't friendly towards us. They were part of the enemy, and they were destroyed. And Mikol Har Yehuda, Mikol Har Yisrael, from all the mountains of Judah and all the mountains of Israel, south and north, Im Areim Echrim Yoshua, Yoshua destroyed all of these places as he was commanded. Lo Natara, Nakim, Be'eretz, B'nei Yisrael, none of these giants were left. Rak Ba'aza, interesting, where were they left? In Gaza. Never ever gone away from us. But Gat Bashdod Nishar, which was the section at the bottom of the country, which was in fact eventually Eretz Plishtim, it didn't even stay in our hands. But Yekach Yoshua, just finished the chapter, Yoshua took it Kol Haaretz, Kol Asher Dibeh Hashem El Moshe, as God had commanded, Vayitna Haaretz, Yoshua Lenachli Yisrael, then began the process of dividing it up to Israel, Kamach Lekotam Neshivteim, according to the division of the tribes, Haaretz, Shaktam Milchama, the end of war. So the big question is, what's going on here? Why did it take so long? Yeah.
Well, here it says that he took the entire land according to what God said to Moses.
Yeah.
So it seems like he did exactly what he
told. He did exactly what he was told, but the time frame is very, very disturbing. As we said, you know, last week we spoke about this war in the south, which was so fast. And it's the area sort of divides itself more or less geographically in terms of size. It's not really that much bigger to conquer the north areas, as you know. And he conquered the south in 3 months. Okay, by Tammuz he was already done. He started in after Pesach, and in the north it's taken 7 years. It's the most incredible thing. And the Rashi brings this comment from the Tanchuma that he was delaying. He was given a promise that he would divide up the land. So he thought, the longer I delay things, right, the longer I will live. He was making a cheshbon about his own life, making a calculation that if I'm still around, it means that God has to keep me alive, which is strange. This is not Yeshua. So again, let me just quote to you, and I'm sorry I didn't manage to photocopy this, but there were a couple of comments here. Again, Rabbi Levi asked the question. He says, "Bevadai ha'elu Yeshua nimukim." He says Yeshua had his reasons. Kvedei mishkal, which are very sort of heavy burdens, la'arichet yimei milchama, to lengthen the war. Afa pisha ayu yimei tzali, so even though he was causing pain to Israel, but what was his machshava? Why would he have lengthened the war? It's very interesting. Yeah. Maybe well thought out also, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he's got to have a reason. I mean, to say that Yeshua was doing this for his own personal gain, that he should live another few years, in the end he was punished by losing 10 years of his life, is very, very difficult. It puts Yeshua in a very different light to anything that we've said till now. Yeah.
I have a completely different take on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then things deteriorate. You get involved with things you should be doing.
Yeah.
That's when our focus starts. So Yeshua's looking and said, look, if there's no war, then what's going to happen to the country? They're going to be divisive. There's going to be arguments. At least we have one common goal.
At the moment, we've got two Jews and one opinion.
Right.
And not three opinions. Right. Yeah, that's
so
right.
If you're going to go too fast, and then, you know, who knows what's going to happen to the people and where their mindset is.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Yeah.
As long as there's a war going on, they can't be active.
Yeah, it's just a scary thing because, you know, it's like, I'm just reading this wonderful book. Mitch put me into this book, which I can't get. I keep overrunning my stop on the subway now because I'm reading this book on the train. I keep missing my stop. It's driving me nuts. And it's got a whole analysis of the First World War and the kind of self-perpetuation of this war. At the expense of literally thousands upon thousands of people getting killed is outrageous. So I hear what you're saying. It does unify the people. It does bring the people together. But it's kind of a scary cheshbon to make. And to make a cheshbon in God's terms. And the irony is that after he finishes the whole thing of conquering the land and dividing the land, he doesn't die straight away. That's the irony. The irony is that he lives for another 14 years. So he thought he was going to die straight away. And then, in fact, God gave him a bracha to live 14 years, but not to 120 years, only to 110. So he was clearly criticized for doing what he did. But on top of that, he was given the extra time, which he didn't even expect to have under normal circumstances. So there was something very odd going on here. There's something which is in the mind of Yoshua, which we have to be, I mean, for want of a better word, try to be don l'kav zchut. So listen to this. And this is Rabbi Levy, and he says like this. It's a phenomenal suggestion, and I just got to share this with you, because I think it's just incredible. He says, what was the nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu? And it says like this. It says in Devarim, "Achrei moti, after I die, ki ashchei tashchitun." Moshe was worried that the Jews would become corrupt. They would go to idolatry. "V'sartem in aderech asher tziviti etchem," and you'll go away from the path which I commanded you. And that was Moshe Rabbeinu's comment at the end of Sefer Devarim. "Kavanat anavuah batarash balpeh aita acha moto shel tamid Yeshua." And the suggestion is that, in fact, when he says after my death, he is actually not just talking after his death, but after the death of his student, because Yeshua represents Moshe. Right? As we said at the beginning of the Sefer, Yeshua in many ways is the continuation of Moshe Rabbeinu. Ki talmido shel adam chaviv alav kagufa. The student of a person is like his body, like his own person. And what Reb Levi wants to suggest is like this. He says, "Chashash for Yoshua b'mnei Yeridat Yisrael mimadrega tam hagavoa b'yamam." In his day, we've pointed this out, I think, before, there was no deviation from the service of God. There was no idolatry, there was no avodah zarah, nothing. Everything was absolutely connected to Hashem. And Yoshua realizes that once he's gone, who knows what's going to be. Look at the book of Shoftim, the first couple of chapters. You can already see, boom, they go right down the tubes. Almost from the beginning. There's nobody to hold them together. Mi Yaleh, it says at the beginning, who's going to lead us? So it says Yehuda Yaleh, but it doesn't mean Yehuda a person, it means the tribe. One of the tribes will be stronger than the other tribes. And they start getting tribal, and by the end of Sefer Shoftim, we've got civil war. Binyamin is killed, and it's horrendous. And all of this is going to come about after Yoshua's death. So his suggestion is something extraordinary. He says that Yoshua was so worried about this, lidchot ad kama she'efshat sakanot or avot lahem b'moto. He wants to push away all of those dangers which are waiting when he dies. V'lechein chashav eitzazoh. He thought of this eitzah. You know what? If I can delay things and schlep it out for another month and another 6 months and another year and whatever, Am Yisrael will hold together. In terms of serving God, they won't be deviating from the script. And that was his plan. That was the suggestion. That's not such a bad suggestion. The issue, however, is that Sata Hashem itakum, the mensch tracht, and got lacht, right? And this is what he's saying here. He says that it wasn't Yoshua's place to make such a cheshbon. Because in the end, 7 years war, 7 years division of the land, and then he lives another 14 years. So he was going to live for another period of time anyway. He wasn't going to die straight away. So Hashem is kind of throwing it back at him and saying to him, Yoshua, you made this calculation with all the good intention, but it wasn't your place to do it, especially as a leader of the Jewish people. Your job is to follow the absolute command. You want to come along and start suggesting, well, if I live a bit longer, and therefore I can stop Israel from sinning, and therefore I can do this, and I can do that, that this is not your place. And Reb Levi says, "Lamadnu et omek hadin b'midah k'negid midah." You see how difficult it is, measure for measure, how God judges the tzaddikim. V'kama medakdek shofet kol haaretz im krovim elav. The ones who are very close to Him, how God is so particular. Amad livnei Yoshua shikul. Yoshua had the possibility lizdareiz b'mitzvah kibush to make the conquest quick. And Ola Harich may melchama or to delay. Kafi machshavto, according to his calculation, v'chriya bebechirato, and he decided that he wanted to delay it because he wanted to save Israel from becoming involved with idolatry while he was still alive. But of course, the kavana of God was not the same. God was going to remove him from the world whenever it was going to be. It's not up to you to make such calculations on behalf of Hashem to play God. All right, and how many times do we hear, I'll never forget, probably one of the worst tragedies. Well, there's so many tragedies that one I don't know which one is worse. I remember in Israel in the 1980s, there was a terrible accident at Petah Tikva. Some children were killed. The bus broke down on a level crossing, and the train hit the bus, and I think 8 children were killed. It was a terrible tragedy. And one of the Chavrei Knesset got up, one of the religious, so-called religious guys in the Knesset, that made everybody's blood boil, including mine, by announcing that, well, I know the reason why this happened, right? You know, I'm playing God. And what did he announce? Because Petah Tikva, at the time, they were opening the cinema, the movie theaters on Friday nights, and he said that was the whole reason. Disgraceful. What a terrible thing to... I know they do it, and it's disgraceful. It's disgusting. And they said that, you know, as if I'm talking in the name of God, they're playing God. And that's the scary thing that we have over here, that this section of Yeshua is telling us Yeshua tried to play God. And he was punished for it. Midah k'neged midah. He lost 10 years of his life. He thought by extending the time of conquest, because it would stop the Jews, even with all the good intentions that he had, in the end of the day, he was punished by God for making this calculation, and he only lived to 110 and not to 120. That's an incredible thing. An incredible thing. And I don't reject it. You know, I mean, Sidney's idea is also very, very interesting. The idea of maybe sort of holding the Jews together in terms of war.
That's a modern reading of Jewish philosophy.
Oh, Jewish philosophy, yeah.
Jewish relationships.
Yeah, that's true. But this idea of him being around, I mean, the reality was that as long as he was around, there was no deviation from serving God. So that was a big thing. It's a suggestion, because otherwise we put Yeshua into such a, I'm going to use the word, almost a mercenary kind of approach. Right, of saying, as long as I'm alive and I can delay the war, everything will be fine. So he keeps delaying, at the expense of carrying on the war with Am Yisrael. Right, like in the First World War, they could have made peace in 1916 and they carried it on to 1918. For what purpose? Nobody really knows. It became the reason for the Second World War, never. Right, you know, Germany was so dissatisfied at the end, and everything built up again to the point where you get the events of the Second World War. So it's kind of scary when one plays around with these kind of situations, and that I think is an interesting suggestion, very bold suggestion, but nevertheless, because it shows that Yeshua did have a kav zechut here. There was a merit for him. I leave you to think about that. And there may be other suggestions as well, but I think that suggestion really works for me. The idea that he really did mean something positive, but not to play God. It's not for us to play God. It's for us just to follow the mitzvahs of Hashem, but not necessarily to take God's place in the world. That's something which is really kind of dangerous. From chapter 12 onwards, as I said at the beginning of the shiur, we're going to essentially sort of move next week, Mitzvah Hashem, to chapter 22. As I said, maybe we'll make one or two comments on some of the parakim in the meantime, but clearly the homework of the day, you know, before you go to sleep, 5 minutes every night, just read one of these chapters. You'll find that it does get a bit repetitive with all the different names of the places. It's nice to read about these names, because obviously in the formation of the modern state of Israel, so much of the naming of towns and kibbutzim particularly, and areas, comes from these chapters. So that's why it's very well known in that context, to people who are into geography. He had obviously his wife and daughters. He didn't have sons.
Married Rachel.
That's again not mentioned in the Sefer, but again, I suppose for obvious reason. It's one of those kind of awkward situations, even though she was such a holy lady, but don't want to publicize it too much. And in terms of children, daughters are not sons. Later on, many, many prophets came much, much later. So he's not directly involved family-wise with the immediate divisions because of daughters. I don't know exactly how it worked. But as when you read this, you'll see how it began to divide up. And there were certain tribes that complained or were very indifferent to the division. They didn't bother. I've forgotten now which tribe it was. They sat around. They didn't actually present themselves to a certain chelik of Eretz Yisrael. The dividing of the land took a very long time. It took 7 years, which is a very long time. Think about it. Yeah, he was the chain in the Masara. Yeah. And there were certain things clearly which were disturbing, and this is one of the serious ones. And Rashi brings it. you know, I don't want to sort of bring this in an obscure midrashic sense, but when Rashi brings it, you realize that this is something very central to the whole discussion. Very, very challenging. We'll see Mitz Hashem next week. We learn chapter 22, which is really the next big story, the issue that he has with the 2.5 tribes. Very unusual, very, very fascinating. And again, by the end, his style of leadership comes through over and over again. This is someone who, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, doesn't really appear on our top 10 list, but is someone very, very special indeed. You know, we always think of Moshe, we'll think of David, we'll think of Shlomo. Yeshua doesn't really feature that much there. The Yahrzeit comes up, I've forgotten now when it is, and people do go and daven by his grave. To this very day, there's always a crowd that goes on the other side of Yeshua and Darwin's there. So, you know, was the, I don't know where it is. I've got a newspaper cutting. I'll have to bring it along and tell you where it is. So, Mr. Shem, to be continued. We're in good shape there. Yeah, there's a minion coming. Mr. Shem, to be continued.